Well, don't have a handout. There is one waiting for you at the end of class, but it was kind of like answers to questions. So I didn't want y'all to have the answers ahead of time. So you'll see it shortly. I wanted to say one quick thing today before we get into the study about a matter in Jewish life that is current. It does relate in some interesting ways to the study that we're going to do today, but it's kind of an interesting little thing itself. It'll just take a minute or two. Today is a sacred day of a post-biblical experience. And I just want to tell you a little bit about it. It is a day that is a very sad and mournful day that actually commemorates, or at least allows people to revisit, the tragedy of the destruction of both temples, which by tradition happened on a day. And other horrible things happened on this day. Some of this is just by tradition. Some of it actually sort of has some historical truth or real historical truth to it. Interesting, relative to what we're studying, is that it's purported that this day is the day when the spies came back and gave the awful report, you know, that they were grasshoppers and didn't have the faith. That purportedly happened as well on this day. One of the things I want to say about the day, just to say something very interesting about something else we'll be studying, and I just think it's a beautiful thing, ritually observant, very observant Jews will take today and fast and be in mourning, sitting low, lights down, reading the Book of Lamentations. That's how serious a day this is for most of the rest of us. We're just mindful of these things. It sort of weighs on us a little bit. But the day itself, the holy day, is called Tisha B'Av, which means in Hebrew, the ninth of Av. It has a date to it, like July 4th. Now, this is kind of interesting. The ninth of Av, which is yesterday. Today's the 10th of Av. Any thoughts as to why the 9th of Av is, which is a tremendously significant, mournful day, would not be celebrated on the 9th of Av? It was a Sabbath. Nothing interferes with joy. Nothing. However horrible it is, nothing interferes with the joy that we feel on the day of the Lord, on the Shabbat. So, anyway, just an interesting thing that's going on. So we come today to a new book. And, of course, if we come to a new book in this class, you all know I have to talk about the name of the book and why I don't like the name we use. In fact, I thought about it. I kind of am okay with Genesis, but not happy about it. Bereshit is a better name. And I have really panned everyone since, which I will do again today. The name, of course, that we use commonly, and we will continue to use on the website, is Deuteronomy, of course. And Deuteronomy means what? Does anyone? Second statement of the law, repetition of the law. And, of course, it is true that this name that the Greeks used came from a Hebrew phrase of one of the sages. So there is some multiplicity of responsibility here for this name. And there is a discussion, mostly in the center of this book, on the mitzvot, on Moses' account of things in the commandments that he wants to emphasize. But there are many more things that he says in these final orations to the people, which is really what this book is about, relating to the journey that they've had, which we've been talking about, his observations on it, which are crucial to them and to us. And then, of course, a discussion of God's expectations, the mitzvot. And then finally, just the most beautiful appeal for what it means to live with God at the end of the book. So, the name of the book in Hebrew, which is the name of this first portion, of course, is Devarim, which means words. So, in a sense, this whole Torah we've been studying begins with God said, the world was created by words. And now the book closes out with Moses' words. And so I like Devarim. I may call it Devarim on occasion. We'll call it Deuteronomy. But anyway, I think it's important for you to understand this business about the book and its name. When was this book written? Now, I shouldn't have even raised that question because I'm not going to address it. Except to say that by tradition, of course, all of this were words revealed by God at Sinai. And that's the tradition. And I stick with the tradition. In a sense, really what I'm saying is I believe these are divinely inspired, divinely revealed words. But there is some historical evidence that that where these words were found, or where these words seem to have been found, were in Judah at the time of King Josiah, 6th century BCE, that seemed to be inspired words from Israel, from the northern kingdom. And you'll see things in these words that scholars say suggest some manifestation at a later time. And so I don't want to get into that. I don't want to debate it. I don't have a, my wife taught me something. There can be multiple truths, and there are multiple faces of people and things. And I've gotten, as I've gotten older, okay with that. So I happen to believe, without any kind of difficulty at all, that these words came from God at Sinai, and there was some manifestation of them in King Josiah's time. I believe both of those, and I'm absolutely fine with it. I don't know about you. So, I hope maybe that you might see it that way. So what are they? What is this book really about? It's designed essentially, as I said, to do three things. It recaps the people's journey together. It's a discussion of these mitzvot that govern the covenant that people have, that these people have with God as they enter the land. And then it's Moses' eloquent plea to the people to stay true to that covenant now and forever in faith. And we're going to talk about faith in a minute. Very powerful appeal. One of the greatest set of orations ever put together in literature or anywhere. And so it's worth studying for those purposes, whether one's thinking ethically, religiously, socially, historically, psychologically, emotionally, politically. It's really kind of got all kinds of beautiful things that ought to be studied for all of those reasons, not to mention religiously, for those of us who are people of faith. So we'll study the structure of these orations, how they're organized, their appeal and purpose, and obviously most important in this class, given its desire, the meaning that these orations had for the people at the time and for us now. So, Jim, with rare exception, I like starting folks off easy since it's the summer. It's just chapter 1, verse 1 to start.
These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the desert east of the Jordan, that is, in the Arabah, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hezeroth, and Dizahab.
Okay, excellent. Well done. I'll be back to you in a second. But there's so much in that, that we want to sort of take some time out and sort of ask some questions. So, whose words are these, and what does your answer to that mean to you? Whose words are these?
It's not the word of Moses.
It's not the word of who?
It's not Moses, because it's third person. It's talking about Moses.
Well, you're making an interesting point, Mike. It's, well, whose words are they not directly?
No.
God's. God's. So they're not God's words. Now, in a way, they are God's words. And we see that as we read through here. They're clearly they're in accord with instructions from God, which we see in verse 3. This is very crucial. They're words that are directly associated with Moses. Now, Mike makes an interesting point. It's not Moses said, these are the words. So there's almost a third person. That's a very astute point. It's almost as if there's a third person account of what Moses said. Now, I want you just to always sort of keep in mind this transition. This is really important right at the beginning. God said, generally, through what we've been reading, God said. And now, these are the words according to Moses. In fact, I haven't even thought about that until you said it. That even sort of gives some, just again, keep thinking about the idea of someone putting these words down somewhere centuries later. These are the words according to Moses. I'm interrupting my own train of thought here. You made me do it. But what's significant about that? What's significant about it saying these are the words of Moses? This is one of those questions you get extra credit on the ID test.
Okay, I'll jump in.
Yeah, do.
We're angels, spirit, and dread. It says to me that this was passed down through the ages.
To?
Told and retold. And retold.
To whom, ultimately?
To the Israelites.
To? The keep going.
Me.
To us.
Yeah.
To me. In other words, the beauty, whoever decided this, all the way from God to the redactor, and I have no problem seeing the role of both either, and I encourage you not to. The idea is, remember we talked about the other four books sort of have a history together? It's complex too. And then there's this one. One of the things I love about what you've just said is that if that's so, if this is the four together and then something is done and a redactor, God or a redactor or both, put them together so that now we have a book that's closer in time to us, or at least has the feel spiritually of being closer to us. So as if we're now closer to this commentary than we are to the other, that says, that shows me that God is reaching to us in the time, in the living, in the communication, in the experience of this. So now someone's saying closer to us, these are the words of Moses. And I just think that's a very interesting thing to sort of think about. Remember too that Moses pleaded at the beginning of this story with God. I am not a man of words. I am not an ish devarim. And now, of course, we have these profound, beautiful words of Moses, who becomes a man of words. A man who speaks in accord with God's word. So let's now go to this next question. So to whom are the words addressed?
To all Israel.
To all Israel. And what does that mean? It's not to the leaders. It's not to the priests. It's to all the people. Which means for us, in the Dearman Christian Perspectives classes, us. These are words for us. Now, let's go to a funny little thing, a funny little literary thing. Speaking of bees, I love that. I mean, how did that happen? How did we get to bees?
So,
it's unbelievable. It's, I don't know whether it's the redactor or what's going on in Zimbabwe or here or whatever. So what's the word for bees in Hebrew? I know y'all know that. Ouch, no. So the word for words is devarim, and the word for bees is devorim. Pretty cool. Now this causes sages, this is one of the things that happens. I just wish we all had time to work on things like this. So there are people, brilliant people, over hundreds of years who see that, and they ask, what's the comparison between bees and these words? Anyone want to take a stab at that? Or a sting or something?
The colony.
Beautiful.
Spread.
Oh, man. I didn't see that in any of the sages. Rav Charlene.
Rav.
Rabbi Charlene. That's lovely. Any others?
Well, like everything is connected to everything in a way. Like, if we lose the bees, it affects everything.
Okay. Good. The bee guy.
Bees are very industrious, very well organized. They know they have different roles to play. They play them very well, and they do it voluntarily.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Something. Yes.
I think of the sounds, you know, they make, and words, you know, have a sound.
This is fantastic. I mean, I've got three or four here, and y'all are the equal of these. Mike?
Sometimes
sometimes words are sweet and sometimes they sting.
That's a that is Mike has hit upon the traditional the traditional understanding among the older savages before we got to the brilliance of this group.
Honey is very sweet and good.
And honey is very sweet and good. That's another one. I mean, this idea that, and the idea that whatever honey we store away, as with words, that we learn and follow, it's sweetness that we keep in store for in this life.
Yeah,
and
lasts forever.
And then what?
It doesn't go bad.
It doesn't go bad, yes.
And if you sting somebody, you die.
Well, now that's another one. You all have, no, that's one of the traditional ones, that Moses delivers these words and dies. And some of these words are chastisement or warnings. They have the effect of a sting. But also this idea that these words can both give sweetness and a sting. And Moses' words do both. Really lovely. Any last ones?
Well, you can also say that bees have leadership. There's a queen bee, and there's leadership.
You just struck off the last one that I had. How did... I mean, y'all didn't even know this. Yes, absolutely. That is the other key point that we follow. There's a structure of leadership and a leader of the bees, the queen bee. And these are words that come and are about leadership. And they encourage leadership in the people, that we should follow them as bees follow the queen bee or the leader. Beautiful job. Golly. Extra credit all around. One more?
Yeah, there's another quote down here. The queen bee is a female.
Ah, I expected as much. Lest it not be said that there's too much sexism in the Bible. Well, I shouldn't even get into that. But the idea that a bee's leader is a female. Absolutely. Okay, let's get back to verse 5. We're still taking it easy. Verse 5.
East of the Jordan in the territory of Moab, Moses began to expound this law, saying...
Okay. I know you're probably... we've got just a minute here, so you've got a second off. You're going to say probably... why is he stopping there? This phrase, Be'er et HaTorah, to explain the Torah. To explain this lesson. I just want to stop for a minute and a half on that. Why am I stopping on that? Explain the Torah. Does anybody have a different translation?
Explain this instruction.
Expound this instruction. Anybody see anything? Well, I got a lot of extra credit questions today. What's so significant about that?
I wanted to reinforce what's
going on. Okay, this idea of reinforcement. But reinforcement. What are we doing as opposed to what we had been doing? Explaining, reinforcing, expounding. This goes to something we were sort of... go ahead.
Showing how it fits today.
Good. Good. Showing how it fits today. Any other comments that where you want to expound on this?
Oh, is it the oral versus the written?
One could say so. We're now into... Remember, we talked about this being closer in time to us? Or at least the feel of it? Or God in the beginning, that's what the traditionalists would say, God in the beginning wanted us to have this feel. This was revealed in the beginning. I can easily go from one position to the other. And they're both true, in my judgment. But this idea that this is sort of a later feel, this is something about Moses, it seems later, and part of it being later is what you've just been saying, that it's now into the understanding. It was in the revealing, and now it's into the understanding and the explication and the attempts to make meaning of it, which is what we're doing today. Moses is doing it, and we're doing it. So that's why I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this this notion that it's really now into understanding and interpreting and finding meaning for ourselves, for them at the time, and for us. Okay, Jim, let's get back to looking at, bear with me a second, 6-8.
The Lord our God said to us at Horeb, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Break camp and advance into the hill country of the Amorites. Go to all the hill country, go to all the neighboring peoples in the Arabah. in the mountains, in the western foothills, and in the Negev, and along the coast, to the land of the Canaanites and to Lebanon, as far as the great river, the Euphrates. See, I have given you this land. Go in and take possession of the land that the Lord swore he would give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants after them.
Okay, two really fascinating things about this text. You have stayed, the account starts. I want you to pay attention to where Moses begins the account. He does mention the patriarchs, but does he begin with them?
No.
Does he begin with Egypt? Does he begin with the redemption? Does he even begin really with Sinai? Now we're going to talk about, he does mention it, but does he really focus on Sinai, the revelation? He's not focusing on the redemption or the revelation. Why does he begin with what he begins with? Yes?
This is a new generation that has to make a choice. Their forefathers made a choice. They suffered for 40 years. Now this new group has to make a choice.
Absolutely. I can't say it any better. Someone want to add to it, though? That's exactly right, Sam. That's right. And this is the important part of this oratory, of these orations. I want you always to be thinking about what he's doing. He's making choices. And he begins in a way that says exactly what you said. I'm here to talk to you about where we're going. And we're going to start on that basis. Now, why does he say specific? So we're going to refer to all the other things, but this is about me and you and the generation that's going to go into the land. And I want to talk to you, and I want to talk to you about that. And that's what he says. Now, why within that does he say, this is the first thing he says, that God spoke to us at Horeb. I won't go into why he says Horeb as opposed to Sinai, but it is there, saying, here's the deal. First words out of the box are, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. That's big. You can't just run past that and studying the Bible. What does that mean?
You have been prepared and it's time to move on.
Okay, you're getting to it. You're ready. In what ways are you ready? Yes, Bill.
Are they comfortable and secure
where they were? Now, where were they? No, he's saying God came to us at Horeb, or Sinai, let's just say, and said, you stayed long enough here at the mountain. I want you to go deeper. You all are getting it. You're getting there, but I want you to go deeper.
You've gotten this instruction. Now it's time to go live it.
Bingo. Bingo. So are we a people? I mean, again, are we? It is important. Our relationship with God is important. What we learn from God, that we're inspired by God. But that's enough. Get away. You've gotten it. Leave the mountain and go into the world. Leave the mountain and go to the land. This is a different view of religion than the ancient practices of there was this site where the oracle would go and you would constantly come back to that space. We don't even know where Sinai or Horeb exactly was. But we know that God talked to us, and we know that God gave us marching orders, and we know that God said, go live in the world. It also says a little something about spirituality is important, but insufficient. A little bit about being with God is important, but living in the world with others is necessary too. All that's in that one sentence, and more. And we just don't have more time to do much more than that. But it's really kind of a very lovely idea. Okay.
That's, of course, part of the message that we should be taking every Sunday as we leave.
Exactly. The beautiful. The last words ought to be, you've been here, move on. You've been at the mountain. This is sort of a mountain. This is a little bit of a, this is like the sacred space.
Years ago, we had a sign above the exit that said, servant's entrance. Entering from the sanctuary into the world.
Beautiful. Oh, I love that. Put it back up. Put it back up. I love that. That is fantastic. So let's go on now to Jim to 15. Now let me just say one thing. We're going to skip the part I do because we're going to come back to it in a way where mysteriously, and it's an important thing just to recognize. I wish we had more time to talk about it. In discussing this, Moses says the reason that I want you to pay attention to the ways he characterizes the past, because it's not exactly the way we read it. He talks about how they burdened him, and they, you know, with all of the demands. That's not exactly what the conversation with Yitro was about, you know, with Jethro. Jethro sensed that he was burdened and said, appoint judges. I just want you to, we're not going to get into why he says things differently and why he emphasizes things differently. I do want you to pay attention in the narrative, in the orations, as to how he characterizes things as you study the Bible. But let's go on to something that Moses emphasizes early on, which are in verses 15 through 18.
So I took the leading men of your tribes, wise and respected men, and appointed them to have authority over you, as commanders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, of tens, and as tribal officials. And I charged your judges at that time, hear the disputes between your brothers and judge fairly, whether the case is between brother Israelites or between one of them and an alien. Do not show partiality in judging, hear both small and great alike. Do not be afraid of any man, for judgment belongs to God. Bring me any case too hard for you, and I will hear it. And at that time, I told you everything you were to do.
Okay. And that, of course, is the process that began as soon as Jethro, his father-in-law, gave him this advice. This is the process that was put in place and became the mitzvot of judging and justice. So, why does the oration go here next? Why do Moses' words go to this place with an emphasis early on in the instruction, in the oration?
Justice has been woven through all of these books.
Exactly. And so, at this stage, when Moses is talking to the people, he would
reinforce it.
He would reinforce it. The emphasis. What's this about? When you leave the mountain? What do I want you to think about? What are we to think about? What is the first thing I want to focus on? Justice. I want to focus on how we judge, how we deal with disputes, how we deal with each other, how we deal with our differences. That there be justice is something I want you to understand and to get a sense of emphasis from me. Yes?
It may also be important that he talks about Israelites and aliens, because they're about to move into an alien land.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Maybe it's like a symbolism of that God, to live a godly life is past religion. I mean, religion can be a good thing to guide us, but really to live a godly life is to live it, encompass it as not to focus always on religion.
Right.
To go with your heart and your...
Well, that's the idea that the sign used to have out here. That's the idea of that lesson that we said, that one line. You got it. You've been at the mountain long enough. Move on. Now that you're moving on, I want you to remember what we've been talking about here. How do we treat each other? How do we make decisions about disputes that we have? There's an emphasis on that. So we're not going to read the rest of this first chapter, but I do want to tell you something about it. I want to ask you a question. So he moves from here into recounting at some length and with many differences as to what happened. I guess when we get older, we think about things differently, or we have a purpose, maybe. I want you to always think about why there seem to be differences in the way Moses is recounting this narrative than what we read in Exodus and Numbers. Is it that he's getting old? Is it that he's getting tired and broken down? Or does he have a reason for characterizing things a certain way. Well, in his account of the spies story, he has several places where it's a little bit different. But I want to just simply ask you, rather than reading it, I want to ask you, why would Moses now in the orations focus significant attention on the tale of the spies? He does. We've lived a long life together on this journey. And it's important to understand why Moses structures his oration in the order that he does. Why, after this emphasis on justice, does he tell the tale of the spies?
None of the people from that generation are left.
Well, that's true. None are left except for Caleb and Joshua and himself.
So he is reminding them what the reason that none of them are left.
That's important. Absolutely. That's important. It is important. He wants them to understand why, what happened and why to that generation. But there's more.
Now they're about to act it out, to face it, to do it.
They're about to go into the land and live, yes. Yes.
And they know they have received the report that there are big people there.
Oh, so part of this is a little bit of a warning.
Yeah, but they're supposed to go anyway.
Fair enough.
Yeah. When you leave the mountain and you set up this system of justice, don't you think that there will always be grasshoppers in your mind? And then they sang that to us all the way to here, that you may have this Bible, you may have this instruction, you may even have Sunday morning or Sabbath for Jews, but you, every week you go out and you feel like a grasshopper.
You can feel like a grasshopper, but now the punchline, we need to have the big conclusion.
They don't want them to rebel again.
True.
They went against the Lord.
True. He probably wants them to understand that if they have these fears that this happened last time. There's all this. Boy, we got teachers in the room.
They have the foundation now. They shouldn't be that afraid. I mean, they've been.
Y'all are so practical. Let's get religious. I want some old time religion. Yes.
I think part of it was the older generation didn't have faith.
Ah, bingo, the big word. Yes, he's saying faith. Have faith. He means all the things you just got through saying. But I think more than anything, he's saying what was missing then, what was missing among the previous generation, what we need to have, what will carry us forward to the land, what goes with justice, is faith in God. Faith in God. We need to have an understanding that God is with us. And it needs, we've spent all this time strengthening up. You're the new generation. And we can't go back. We need to understand the problems. It's not easy, but we need to understand that God will be with us. That's the reason I think that Moses makes such an emphasis on this at this time in the story. Now, there's a yes.
I think we go back a few weeks ago where the elders went on their reconnaissance and came back with this terrible story. We can't do this. It can't be done.
Right.
These went and came back with fruit and how great the land was that the Lord had given us.
Well, the ones who remain, that's Caleb and Joshua. That was their narrative. That's a good point. In other words, the ones who remain were the ones who came back with the positive account, which bolsters faith. That is to say, the worldview of the ones of you who remained from that generation was of optimism, was of the bounty, was of God's bounty. They saw the world. We understand that we can feel like we're grasshoppers. But we also can have the view that the survivors of that generation, and you need to have, that it's a land of milk and honey. It's a land of huge grapes. It's a land of opportunity in the future. Yes?
I say they've already fought a couple battles under the Spirit of the Lord and wiped out their enemies, and Israel is supposed to be great big people. Some king had a bed that was an iron bed that was 13 feet long or something.
And Moses brings up the successes too, just for that reason. Always be thinking about the purpose of what you're doing with this new generation and talking to them. And we'll talk about in a moment the point you just made. He will bring up again and again, we've had success. We've won some battles with God's support. So that's a very, very important thing. Any other final comments before we go? I do want to mention to you, we don't have time to dwell on it, but Moses seems to have this, he keeps referring here to his problem with God in not being able to go into the land, has something to do with something that he's being blamed for on their account, that maybe it goes back to the spy story, and that it's not the striking of the rock. We don't have a lot of time to get into what that is. Are those two strands of thought, or is there a little bit of a sense that there was complicity in the way, or a memory, or is it a tactic of a psychological tactic to say, I'm with you. I was a part of that problem. I'm trying to explain why I'm not going into the land with a little different gloss. Yes?
I was going to say, they said none of that generation was going to go into Israel. Why would Moses be an exception?
That is right. And there's one tradition of thought, or God wanted us to see both. I keep saying that. Of Moses was a part of that generation. But that's not the way Numbers had it. Numbers had it that God said to Moses only after Moses struck the rock instead of speaking to it. Words. That's interesting. Not with words, but he struck the rock. We talked about this a lot. That it was only then that the decision was made that he couldn't go in the land. I don't want to get into too much of this, but I do want you to be aware of the complexity of all of that. We've spent a lot of time on... I just want you to keep thinking about the structure of these orations. And you all have talked about it. He's clearly making the apostasy of the past apparent to them. And he's teaching about it and warning about it. But he's drawing a distinction between that of the previous generation and this stronger new generation. But he wants them to understand that the lure, the what causes the apostasy, what leads us away from and stray from God, is an ever-present allure. So he's trying to make a distinction between the past and the present. He's trying to show them the strength that they've garnered and the success that they've had in life, and that they're ready and able to go in, but they too will face some of the same temptations that afflicted their predecessors. Yes.
From God's point of view, that's a done deal. This is the promise. And he's told him that, hasn't
right.
he?
He had, but he had 40 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Moses is dealing with people whose parents could have gone in, from God's point of view, and should have gone in. When God said, that's why we started this, time to leave the mountain and to go straight into the land. And that's why Moses says, I want to talk to you about the spies. I want to talk to you about justice, and I want to talk to you about faith. And I want to talk to you about, and I want to talk to you in a way that you can understand me and understand the authority with which I speak, because I was part of that. But he wants them to understand the loss their predecessors experienced without scaring them, you see. And he wants them to have a sense of their own responsibility and the strength they have, the fact that they have won some victories, that they had over Sihon and Og in particular, and that they understand that this was God's design. These are all the points that you've been making. These are the strategies that Moses is using in these orations, and that it's their time with these warnings to go in and take the land. Now, Jim, let's go back to, I'm going to make a brief stop at chapter 2, verses 4 through 7.
Give the people these orders. You're about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. The Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He has watched over your journey through this vast desert. These 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked anything.
Okay, we went on a little. That's good. That's good. Why do you think God tells Moses and Moses tells the people to skirt the land of Esau?
Because that wasn't their promise.
That's the first answer. Absolutely. That was not part of their promise.
No.
We have two other possible answers or more. Yes.
And maybe it's shown that the Lord keeps his promises.
And which promise are we talking about?
Well, the promise that the Israel is theirs. Yeah, Canaan is theirs.
Right. And not this land.
Not this. Honored these people and gave them that, and they have it. And honor these people and gave them that, and they have it. Why wouldn't he honor you and give you some land also?
Beautiful.
And not only that, they eliminated their... Eliminated the people who are already there, and it's all theirs.
Okay. These are all great answers. Anybody else? Yes.
And the Lord had promised to Esau and his descendants too, right?
Yes. That's where I wanted you to go. That's the second part of it. You remember how the Lord made the commitment to Esau? Do you remember that? We studied Esau with his father and his brother, and it was the dream of the father that the two sons would each have a future. And so in a sense, remembering back to those commitments that we make and that God makes and honoring them, even into generation after generation. That's an important part of this story, too. And that this isn't killing and conquest for its own sake. This is not about power. I mean, they had the power to take this land, probably. But this is not about killing and conquest. This is about honoring promises and commitments that are made. Let's go now to... Yes?
Does this little section have any relevance to the current conflicts in the Middle East? I guess, to me, it seems like it must.
Well, it probably does, but with 10 minutes to go, I can't go there. Modern geopolitical issues are very complex, as you know. Let's go to chapter 3, 21 and 22.
At that time, I commanded Joshua, "You have seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. The Lord will do the same to all the kingdoms over there where you are going. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God himself will fight for you."
Okay. What is this? Why does he bring Joshua in and the role that Joshua is to play, what Joshua has done and seen, and the role that Joshua is to play here? Why is this brought in at this point? Right. Setting up as a leader. Why Joshua? Why emphasizing Joshua? He is the leader. But why emphasizing Joshua's leadership now? What does he say? What does he say specifically here about what Joshua is able to do that none others can do?
He was there.
He was there.
He had been a spy. He had been
one of the spies. Well, he had not only been one of the spies and saw the land and was true to God. He saw who's left who saw God's miracles. Joshua and Caleb. That's it. So what he's trying to do here is to connect back to that part of the earlier generation that saw God's miracles, not just had faith in God's hand in the land, but went back all the way to Sinai, went back to the redemption and Sinai. It's an important part of the past that needs to be taught to the future. And Joshua was able to do it. Now, let's go now to a question that I want to ask you. And this was in the handout that you haven't gotten yet, because that was the answer. And here's the question. So, and we just have a few minutes. I want you to mostly think about it. I just want some first quick reactions, and I want this to be in your heads for the rest of Devarim, this book. So, Moses clearly focused, as is God, on how the people, this generation, enters the promised land. This is all about readiness to enter the promised land. And we're going to read more and more about what Moses says and does to be sure that they are best able to enter the promised land. So here's the question I want you to be thinking about for these 9 or 10 weeks we have left together. What's the promised land? Now, you can answer that. Now remember, we have a deal here together. The clothes, the body, and the soul. That's our deal. And you can answer my question by showing me the clothes of the person, and that's going to be true. Or you can begin to think about the body and the soul of the answer to my question. So who wants to give a try? Somebody deal with the clothes first. Yes.
Oh.
No, go ahead. Go on, deeper.
I was going to try that. Is the promised land really living into that covenant relationship that God intended?
What's the deal with you guys? You know, I know. I used to be like you when I was in the second grade. I'd go home, and you know, I would go home to my mother and I'd say, "I got more stars than anybody in the class." And you know, I still am a little bit that way. A lot of stars for that answer. Obviously, what the clothes are. This is the geographical land. This is the space that God promised, and we know its boundaries and so on. But I think you're right. I think you're right. And so what does that mean to us? What is the promised land? What do we think more? I mean, let's go even one step further. Let's go from the clothes and the soul, which I think you're bordering on.
Eternal life.
One could get there.
Yeah.
One could get there with it. How do we live, right? I mean, how the promised land is living in covenant with God. That's the promise. And the promise is, as long as we live in covenant with God, in closeness to God, as God expects, we're blessed. And all these riches, the grapes, the honey, all of that is God's blessing of shalom, or God's blessing of peace, of mercy, of acceptance, of eternal life. All of those things. When we live as God expects, when we live with God, one can think about. I want you to be thinking about the promised land in all of its dimensions as we go forward. Now, let's conclude with, I don't know if we're ready to conclude. Moses says, I do want to conclude with this question. Moses, at the end of this portion, Moses says this: "Don't fear them," and I want to ask you who them. We know who them are at the close of the answer, but I want you, "Don't fear them, for it is the Lord your God who will battle for you." This is the last part of the oration that we get in this portion. "Don't fear them, for it is the Lord your God who will battle for you." What does that mean? Why does he say that? That way, and what's he really basically saying? And you might say, who's them? Who's them? When he says, "Don't fear them." Yes.
To get past the close, I guess, you know, this is the promise that we live. I mean, you have this body, you have this book, this journal of these people, where you see incident after incident, where God made promises, God kept faith, and in your own life, you should live the promise. And the promise is that God is with you. God mm-hmm. will do. God will battle for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'll be sojourners together.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Other thoughts? Yes.
Well, the them are outsiders who are not part of the faith.
Oh, you think so? Maybe. Maybe.
No.
I like that. I like people just saying no. You know,
but
what's another? Let me put it another way. What's another way of looking at them?
Well,
Don't fear them.
Oh, maybe it's the doubters in their own group.
Could be.
The naysayers.
Or the them is not a them. Maybe the them is not a
person. Well, then what is them? If them is not a person.
But all kinds of ghosts you have.
Good. Good. Yes.
Somehow all this reminds me of when God told Abram to get up and go.
Yeah.
Abram went. He's telling these people, you've been here long enough. Go.
Right.
Trust me. Don't worry about what's ahead of you. I'm on your side.
God is on your side. Whatever the thems are, whatever the anxieties, whatever the fears, whatever the thoughts about being a grasshopper, whatever the enemy physically, whatever the doubting inside, whatever it is that caused your ancestors to pull back, remember God battles for you. Yes.
Remember, too, God is the judge. We aren't. We can't be so arrogant to think that Christians and Jews are the only right ones. So God judges, even though you have to be so careful. We're not to judge.
Well,
the gift of having God in our life.
Okay.
We have an easier road.
Okay, y'all have gotten into a little deal here. And I don't want us to even get caught up with them, these ideas right now.
We have to be careful about being
I do. I agree. Let's not get off into judging or not judging. I want to get back to this issue of them. Don't fear them.
I think it's your doubts within yourself.
You think it's your doubts with... Good. And so what is it that allows, strengthens us to not fear them?
Faith.
Trust. The Lord is in it, but it's faith and trust in God. Right.
Well, when I said outsiders, I mean those who do not have faith.
Okay. Okay, good.
That's all I meant.
Fair enough. Good. I'm glad we wrapped that up. Because I wouldn't want that to be something that we have to fear. But I like that. That is to say that don't fear those who do not have faith. Is kind of what you're saying. And so this emphasis on faith, the emphasis on faith in the discussion of the spies, the emphasis on faith here, this is crucial. And I just want to make this point. I don't want to get into it too deeply. It's for another day. But I do want to make a very strong point. We've studied enough of the Hebrew Bible for me to be able to say to you, there is no faith works dichotomy in the Hebrew Bible. There's no faith works dichotomy in the Hebrew Bible. So I'm not going to get into who said there was, or why, or whatever they were saying, or get into a fight, pick a fight with that person, or those people. But I want you to know by studying the Bible, and by studying these deep and profound emphases on faith, that is as important. That's why I like the word Devarim for this book, as opposed to Deuteronomy. Because part of the words, in fact, a significant part of the words, and I think the central part of the words in this first portion is faith. The absolute importance of having faith in God above all else. We haven't even touched a work or a commandment or anything yet. Moses says at the beginning, we should have faith. And with this faith, we can survive our fear of all the thems that we might ever face, including kingdoms and powers and all else external or internal that threatens, because we live in confidence that the Lord our God will battle for us. This is central to our spirit, must be, and our consciousness as we prepare to enter and then live in the land of God's promise. Now, next week, do you remember American Bandstand?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Casey Kasem, may he rest in peace? Were there ever weeks, now somebody's going to say, hey, you can go some religious, spiritual stuff to Casey Kasem. But I do that. I do that because I think that's part of living as we go out from the mountain, bringing Casey Kasem and American Bandstand into our lives. But do you remember those weeks when you were sure that at least three of the top 10 tunes were among your favorites of all time. You remember those? And you weren't going to miss it. Next week, at least three of your all-time favorites in the Bible will be on the show. You have to be here. Have a good week, everybody.